This is Unfortunate History.
Hey everybody, welcome to Unfortunate History, a podcast that covers interesting, wacky, and unfortunate moments in history. I'm Cody Pennington.
And I'm Greg Skinner.
And today, we'll be diving into the deep underbelly of the London crime world. We'll be discussing the two most insanely different, but literally identical crime bosses, the Cray Twins. Greg, you probably don't have any firsthand experience with the Cray Twins, but I'm sure you have experience with knowledge of the Cray Twins, right?
Yeah, I've heard of the Crays. They've got quite a big legacy over here in England. So obviously there was the recent Tom Hardy film as well.
That's true.
So that kind of keeps it fresh in the mind. But yeah, there is a... I would have heard of the Cray Twins. So it makes a change for me in this episode because I actually know something about them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Be it very little.
Well, no, it kind of seems like they're like, I mean, we did the episodes on Billy the Kid and that sort of thing. So they're kind of like, are they folk heroes to English people? Like criminals, but more anti-heroes almost?
They do kind of have that about them, yeah. I'd say so. Almost definitely.
Well, if the listeners don't know who the Cray Twins are, identical twins Ronnie and Reggie Cray were two prolific crime lords who owned London's East End during the 1950s and 1960s. They were known for their tempers, but also for their pride in the East End and its people. They developed a reputation as kind of the East End's unofficial police. However, their story also developed into one of mistrust, betrayal, and murder. Now, today's episode will focus a lot on the twins' upbringing and more of Ronnie Cray's story. But that's not to say we won't touch on Reggie, but this will be more of a Ronnie episode. In the next episode, the story will come back together a bit more for the conclusion. We'll basically be using both episodes to fill in the gaps of each other. That way, you're forced to listen to both episodes, basically.
Yep. If you don't leave one more, well, you got to wait through this one to get to the next one.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's called entrapment.
That's why you get listeners, man.
That's the only way you get listeners is make them come back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, real quick before we start the story, the sources for this episode are Ronnie and Reggie Cray's book, Our Story, and their brother, Charlie Cray, his book, Me and My Brothers. Also, a few documentaries were used that were speckled here and there. You can actually find a lot of documentaries on the twins on YouTube. So if you'd like to find those, feel free to go watch them. They're kind of shit.
But they are always shit when they're on YouTube.
It's not great. They don't have fantastic ones. So the information that comes from YouTube, I will point it out and I'll let you know. It is actually professionally done documentaries, but they're very old and you could tell that they probably were not very big even at the time that they were released. So I will point out that information to let you know that you should take it with a grain of salt.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then.
Now, to understand the Cray Twins, it's important to understand their London upbringing and the family who brought them up. In terms of the environment, the twins were children during the Great Depression, born into a very rough part of London, the East End. This area of London had a very interesting relationship with the police. As the East End was a very poor part of London, crime was much more prevalent than other parts of the city. So the citizens in the East End and the police obviously had experience in dealing with each other. However, they definitely didn't see eye to eye. And one particular area the East Enders and the police disagreed very strongly on was gambling, most notably horse races, because these were more popular at the time.
Okay, well, so was it illegal to gamble then? Was that a thing?
It's not that it was illegal to gamble. I'll get onto the illegality and the legality of gambling in just a moment. But Greg, I wanted to point out, did you grow up in a place that's kind of harsh or near a place that was kind of harsh?
My entire place of upbringing was a shithole. Like, so I do get the reference there between the police and the people and no one really liking the police. So that's something that hasn't really gone away, that especially in poorer, rougher areas.
No, not really at all. Now, at this particular time in history, the laws surrounding horse track betting were quite strict. They weren't illegal, but they were very strict. If you wanted to place a bet, you had to actually be at the horse track. This was known as on-track betting. However, most of the people living in the East End were poor. They couldn't afford to spend their days at the track. They had 27-hour jobs to attend to, you know? So as a workaround to on-track betting, the EastEnders developed illegal gambling clubs. Basically, these clubs allowed working-class EastEnders the opportunity to place a bet on the races. These clubs would then send people called runners to the tracks to actually place the bets. And then obviously, if there were winnings, they would send runners to retrieve the winnings, and then they would be sent back. It's a very hairy situation, but it's a workaround because obviously the poor people couldn't go to the tracks every day. They just couldn't do it.
No. And so I guess like it is kind of taking advantage of an addiction as well, which gambling is, I suppose. And but in that day and age, it's probably all you really had to do to pass the time aside from drink.
That's a very good point, actually, because that is the way gambling is described. It's not described as an addiction at this time. Gambling is described as an escape.
Yeah.
In this time, it was like a way for them to, I don't know, I can't even fathom it because I find it difficult to even buy a, you know, what do you call it? A lottery ticket. Like, I know the odds are against me. You know what I mean? I know the odds are against me. But these people saw it as a way to escape their normal daily lives. It was like a risk-taking thing. Like, oh, I'm putting my money and I'm risking and I'm having a good time. It's a little bit of excitement when I get off at the coal mine and I'm covered in piss and my own shit because I couldn't leave my workspace because my boss literally will chop off a toe if I leave. Like, that kind of shit. It gives them the escape. It's really interesting, actually. So that's a really interesting point. Now, it wasn't long before the police got wise to these illegal gambling clubs in the East End. However, it's argued that instead of punishing the illegal gamblers, the police began to take advantage of them. Whenever these people were caught placing bets at illegal clubs, they would be placed into custody for an evening, fined in the morning, and then just released. And that process would repeat over and over. And the people of the East End took particular offense to this because they were obviously being exploited by the police. So, mistrust in the police in the East End built very quickly. This particular fact will come into play during the Cray's rise to criminal power. In essence, the East End was full of crime, but everyone hated the police. Now, it's not necessarily true that every child raised in an environment like this becomes violent. Look at Greg. He's not very violent.
Nope, I'm a very upstanding citizen and a very, very, very lovely man, I say with aggression.
But it is obvious that environments such as these do have an effect on some children.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we've set the scene for the twins' childhood, we'll also need to discuss some of their more important and interesting family members. Arguably the most important person to the twins was their mother, Violet.
Okay.
She is described as a very mild-tempered woman. The twins claim that she would never raise her voice to them, much less her hand. They saw her as a complete angel, and they would literally kill anyone who would speak ill of her.
Now, could it be argued that that's why they ended up the way they did, in the kind of violent gangland way of life, because they seems like they could get away with anything?
Well, not necessarily that. There are times in the Cray's book where they discuss their mom being upset with them, but she just wasn't violent.
Okay.
So she did discipline them in a way, but it seems like it's described that they didn't want to disappoint their mother.
Okay.
Now, the twins' father, Charles Cray, was a successful market dealer. He would actually call at random upper-class homes to buy anything of value to resell at his family-owned street stalls. We'll discuss this in a moment, but it was Charles who may have inadvertently caused Ronnie Cray to develop his mistrust of the police. Reggie's mistrust came from a different childhood moment, which we'll also discuss.
Okay.
Very interesting moments that we'll get to in just a second. Now, as an important note, Charles Cray should not be confused with Charles Cray Jr. or Charlie, the twins' older brother. Their older brother was not their father. Obviously.
Really? Okay.
What?
That would put a twist in it.
That would be very unfortunate history.
Well, it turns out there is actually a rumor that Reggie and Ronnie were in, actually, they like to participate in a incestuous relationship with one another. Again, just a rumor and a gross rumor. But
well, I guess that brings up the point of, would you fuck yourself if you had the chance?
I'd fuck me. I'd totally fuck me.
I'd fuck me. Yeah. Can you look at yourself in the mirror and honestly say that you wouldn't try it on with yourself?
Honestly.
They lived the dream, Greg.
with all this lockdown weight I've gained, I generally, every time I look in the mirror when I'm in just my underpants, and I go, you piece of shit, you're so gross.
Let me teach you a lesson for getting all this weight.
You're disgusting. Spank me. Spank me.
Now, the twins' grandfather, Charles Cray's father, was Jimmy Cray. Both Charles and Jimmy worked for themselves in the market stalls. Now, these two men shared an interest in something that would shape the Cray twins' lives from a very young age. Boxing. They loved boxing. In fact, it seems that everybody in this time period loved boxing. However, Charles and Jimmy Cray's interest in boxing was purely recreational. It was the twins' grandfather on their mother's side, Jimmy Lee, who would ingrain the love of boxing into the twins. But before them, he ingrained it into their brother Charlie. Not important to the story, just know that that's where Charlie's love came from. Nobody really cares about Charlie.
Yeah, that was the sad log. You were saying it, like, what the fuck has Charlie done? Like, he doesn't have a film with the beautiful Tom Hardy, and it doesn't have any of this.
He will absolutely have a part to play in the second episode. But this episode, not much to say about Charlie.
Fuck Charlie.
Yeah, fuck him.
For this episode, anyway.
Now, let's talk about Jimmy Lee. He was ridiculous. Jimmy Lee was an incredibly intense athlete. He was a bare-knuckle boxer prior to the birth of the twins. He was described as an incredibly tough boxer even until his old age.
I think most people were kind of tough around those parts and that time. I don't think you had much choice. Otherwise, you will just be a victim.
Absolutely, they were all tough. But Jimmy Lee was an absolutely different breed of man. Throughout his bare-knuckle boxing career, he had garnered the nickname Southpaw Cannonball. And as an example of his fitness, on one particular occasion, the twins' uncle had driven a coach party 42 miles south from London for a getaway from the town. Shortly after the coach party arrived at their destination, Jimmy Lee also arrived on a bicycle. He had cycled the full 42 miles and was more than willing to complete the return journey. He was 75 years old at the time.
And you know what? I bet, because everyone smoked back then as well, so I bet he was a smoker too. Like,
and he had smoked 4 cigars during that bicycle ride, I'm telling you, man. You just see him flying down the motorway with this puff of smoke.
Like, keeping up with traffic, like, legs going full pelt.
But he's, like, actually passing cars. Like, get out of my car, what the fuck's wrong with you?
Get out my fucking way, you slags. Here it is. The accent's coming out. We're on the East End. It's got you slag. Get out my fucking way, yeah. Caught me in it, yeah, from the East End, yeah. let me just get out my system and then we'll be able to carry on with the episode because I've been holding it in so far.
Oh, wait, I thought was that it?
Yeah, it was. That was me putting a full stop on it.
I thought you had more to give.
I'm trying Okay, let me think of what quotes were from the film. Give me your sausage.
I think he was saying, what does he say? I came here for a proper shootout. Didn't he say that?
Okay, Mia, for a proper suit hat, like a Western.
That's pretty damn good.
See, to you, it sounds good because you're
That's
American.
That's hilarious. No, I like in the film when Reggie is so upset with Ronnie for doing the last part of this of today's episode. We're going to discuss a moment after Ronnie comes back to Reggie. He looks at him. He's like, Ronnie, you're fucking nuts. You're fucking nuts. Get yourself sorted. You're fucking nuts. Oh, my God. Now, all of these previously mentioned men in the Cray family, Jimmy Lee, Jimmy Cray, and Charles Cray, all of them transferred their love of boxing to the twins. Before the twins, however, was their brother Charlie, like I mentioned a moment ago. Charlie was the real young boxer of the family. He was a bit older than the twins, I believe by about 8 years or so, I'm not 100% sure.
That's a pretty big gap.
That's a pretty big gap, yeah. And by the time the twins became interested in boxing, he had already become very proficient. Charlie had already won boxing championships during his time in the Navy when the twins were old enough to ask him for boxing lessons. Charlie agreed and introduced the twins into the world of boxing firsthand. Or at least He introduced them into the world of beating the shit out of other people. Now, Reggie Cray, often seen as the more level-headed of the twins, was seen to be the more proficient boxer. He was described as cold and calculated, while Ronnie Cray, often seen as the batshit crazy one of the twins, was seen as more of an animal in the ring. His goal was to just put each opponent on their back. Though they were developing different fighting styles, they were making themselves into forces that would prove to be incredibly difficult to control, especially by the police.
Fuck the police, coming straight from the underground!
Come on, man, I don't want to have to beep that. I don't want to have to pay royalties to the fucking...
I'm sure there's a time limit. I'm sure that can be in.
You can do it if it's under 6 seconds.
And that was...
I'm not going to take that risk, bro. I'm not going to have Dr. Dre beating down my door for a fucking fiver.
Dr. Dre coming in. I came here for a shootout, like a Western.
Ice Cube comes in, like, you're fucking nuts. I don't even know if Dr. Dre was in Run DMC. I don't even know if that was Run DMC. Was that Run DMC?
No, it was fucking NWA.
NWA, my bad.
God, we are so white.
I'm incredibly white. I can tell you all about John Mayer, okay? Now, earlier we mentioned that the twins both developed a distrust in the police at early ages. We'll first start with Reggie, because he's quite interesting. Reggie's distrust began on an unfortunate train ride. He was on a train with his family coming back from a picnic. Well, on this train, Reggie had an air pistol with him, which seems like an odd thing for a child to just have. I don't know.
It's a different time.
Absolutely. Now, anyway, he decided to fire this air pistol out the window of the moving train. A guard on the train saw him do this, and he grabbed him and locked him in a cabin. He basically placed him under arrest, so to speak. Now, it wasn't actually the fact that Reggie was locked away that upset him. Instead, Reggie said that the police went overboard with their treatment of him, and it upset his mother. And this is likely the main reason that this incident affected him so much, because obviously, like we said, the twins had a huge affection for their mother. However, there is another moment in Reggie's childhood that actually describes his distrust in authority figures in general. When he was around 8, Reggie was playing with a friend of his named Alf. Alf was hired by a truck driver to start his engine for him and sometimes help him load the truck for deliveries. I say hired, but he basically just gave him some pocket change to help him load the truck every now and then, just as, kind of as a general helper for this truck driver.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on this particular occasion, Alf asked Reggie if he'd like to, quote, take a ride with him, obviously somewhat jokingly. However, Alf put the truck in gear after starting the engine, and this caused the truck to jerk backwards and crashed into a concrete barrier. The two boys heard a scream from behind the truck. They both went to the back of the truck and found that a 6-year-old boy had been smashed between the truck and a concrete structure. The child's head was crushed, and even Reggie, at such a young age, could see that the child was dead.
Jesus Christ! They don't put that in the film, do they?
They do not put that in the film.
Fucking hell. Brutal.
Now, further to this incident, after the incident, the truck driver came to the children and told them to lie for him, or he would lose his pension. He told them to say that he had never hired Alf to start the engine. When there was an inquiry into the incident, the boys admitted that they had messed with the truck's gears, but they didn't admit that Alf had started the engine. And after this incident, Reggie stated that he hated the man for putting his pension above the child's life. To make matters just a bit worse for Reggie, the child he had killed was also a twin.
Oh, so extra reason to kind of relate to that, I guess. Yeah. That's dark from an early age. I wasn't expecting the kid to have his head crushed by a fucking truck.
It's awful. And it was actually said the concrete structure was said to be a bomb shelter, because obviously the bombings were happening around this time. The Blitz and all that stuff. So there was a bombing structure behind this truck, and that's what he was smashed in between. Very terrible. Very, very brutal stuff. But obviously that affected him from that age, and the fact that it was covered up, basically, made him distrust people that were, you know, from a young age, you're taught to respect authority, but their authority is just older people.
Mm-hmm.
And that ingrained in him a distrust of pretty much all authority. And then, obviously, the train incident pushed the fact that he distrusted uniforms even more.
Mm-hmm. Back to the point where we had an air gun on a train. When I was, like, 12 or 13, I got taken home by the police for having a BB gun. and shooting, being shot and shooting at my friend. And I,
oh, wow.
And I cried a lot because I was terrified.
I can imagine. You hate the police, don't you?
My brother's a police officer.
Oh, that's true. Fuck the police, coming right from an underground.
Fuck the police! My brother, fuck him! No, not really. He doesn't fucking listen to me anymore. I tell him to anyway, so I can say what I like. Fuck off, the lot of you.
Oh, I wonder if we have any cops. If we have any cops listening, feel free to email us in. We love everybody, honestly, that listens. Unless you're a racist asshole, don't email us, please. But other than that, if you're a cool person, email us. Now, Ronnie, on the other hand, developed his hatred for uniforms in a different way. The twins' father, Charles, was called upon at one point for his military service, as most people were. However, he decided to refuse this call and instead went, quote, on the trot. Now, going on the trot basically meant he evaded the police and military whenever they would call at the family home, which they did daily. He basically left the house and just didn't come back. And he would come back randomly, but obviously he had to be out and about doing stuff to avoid them. Now, going on the trot just sounds truly fucking exhausting. It just sounds exhausting.
It kind of does. But again, we live in an age where we're all kind of lazy and we have fine things to do in the house. I suppose just being out and about back then was probably like a big pastime.
Yeah. Now, every day, these men in uniform would come looking for Charles. And every day, the Cray family would lie to them about his whereabouts. Now, Ronnie and Reggie were both said to be able to lie almost like they were born to do it. But the family wouldn't just lie to the police. The twins' Aunt Rose, Violet's sister, would sometimes scream obscenities at the cops and whoever else showed up looking for Charles. Now, obviously, with living in the East End and living with such a violent and crazy family, you can see where a pretty unhealthy relationship with the police can begin to grow.
You fucking wankers, you coppers, fuck up! You fucking wankers!
Oh, well, the twins' hatred for anyone in a uniform will come into play a little later, but as luck would have it, they didn't really have any other run-ins with the police until they were actually 16. The twins got into a gang punch-up with another group of young boys at this time. However, afterwards, one of the rival gang members broke a rule that no one in the East End was meant to break. Now remember, we mentioned that the people of the East End did not trust the police. They didn't speak to them. Well, one of the boys from the rival gang decided to go to the police and grass on the Crays. For my American friends, he ratted on them to the police.
Mm-hmm.
Even at this early age, the Crays understood the severity of this, and they felt that it was, quote, completely unforgivable.
Don't be a grass. Snitches get stitches and that.
Yeah. You don't grass up on somebody. Not to the police, especially not in the East End. As we said, they don't trust them. So you just don't fucking go to the police. What are they going to do? You know what I mean? You'll ruin everybody's lives. Just don't go to the fucking police. Now, a more severe run-in with the police came a little while later. Ronnie says in the twins' book that he, Reggie, and some of their friends were together loitering outside a store when he was violently shoved from behind. When he turned to see who it was, he found it was a cop telling him and his friends to move on. Without thinking, Ronnie just knocked the cop out with a single punch. Then the boys just scattered. Now, a few moments later, the boys were found by two other cops who took Ronnie away. And Reggie didn't like that. So, he headed back to the shop where the boys were at before, found the cop Ronnie had knocked out, and knocked him out himself. And Reggie was then thrown in the same cell as his brother. Now, these run-ins with the police started a trend for the twins. The Crays began making headlines, and they began making a name. The twins were soon summoned to serve a stint in the military, as most men were at the time. It's just a thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the twins' father was still on the trot at this point, for years at this point. And they saw how difficult it was to keep running from this military obligation, and they decided that they would prefer to not spend their lives running. However, they also hated uniforms, so this presented a bit of a pickle when joining the military.
Yeah, like, you know, the whole, it's there's a lot of uniforms in the military, and there's a lot of hierarchy.
Arguably, there are all uniforms in the military.
Yeah, there's literally nothing but uniforms in the military.
Now, the twins sat down with each other and they discussed the option, as they did with everything. That's actually very impressive. They always sat down and discussed options with situations. And they decided that they would join the military if they were allowed to be physical fitness instructors. They felt that this would be mutually beneficial to the military and to themselves. It would allow them to stay in shape while also allowing them to serve their time simultaneously. So they went to the Tower of London and they made their demand to the corporal in charge. The corporal, not too amused by the order of the twins, said, "You'll do what you're bloody well told." Or, Greg, if you want to say that as a Londoner.
"You'll do as you're bloody well..." No, I can't. Fuck. Let me think. Let me take this
"You'll
back.
Do
Let
as you're bloody well told."
"You'll do as you're bloody well told, you slag."
"You slag.
You slag. Listen, you slag. You'll do as you're bloody well told."
Yeah, there you go. To this, the twins said nothing, and they turned to leave. He asked where they were going, and they told him that they were going home. Stupidly, the corporal grabbed a hold of Ronnie's arm to stop him leaving, and Ronnie responded with a quick punch to the jaw, knocking the corporal out cold, and thus began the twins' tumultuous relationship with the military.
Just like everyone else.
Everyone else. They did indeed go home that night, actually, and then decided to attend a local dance. And the following morning, they were picked up by the military police. They didn't resist because, as I said, they preferred to not run constantly like their father did. They did, however, hope that the military had changed their minds about letting them be fitness instructors. They had not.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they had.
No, they had not. When they arrived back at the Tower of London, the twins were charged with being absent without leave and striking an officer. However, the twins pulled a gambit that they used quite often in their younger years. They pretended that neither of them had struck the officer. And the officer couldn't really prove who had done it since they were identical. But since they couldn't decide who had done it, they gave them both time in the guard room, which I assume is something like a jail. And the twins did not like this, so they decided to escape.
Don't you just casually escape, like, you know, just we're just going to, okay, we'll just go now. Like, what the fuck?
Well, they easily escaped. They literally just escaped. And there's no real mention of how. They just kind of escaped. And they actually ended up going on the run like they didn't want to do in the first place.
Is this just how, like, people get out of cells and jails? Is it just you have to believe in yourself? Is that, or if you believe you'll escape, well, the door's just open? Because that's what I feel like it is.
Yes.
Because whenever you hear about these, like, prison breaks and stuff, it's always, like, really stupid how they've done it, like, how easily they managed to pull it off.
Well, it only works if you're an identical twin.
I guess so. Who was that serial killer who broke out of prison like 3 times?
Ted Bundy.
His way is he just lost loads of weight and squeezed through the ceiling. It's like, I think you just got to be driven enough and anyone can get out of prison.
You know what? I'm not saying that he earned that sorority killing. I'm just saying that he worked for it.
If anyone deserved to kill a sorority, it was old Buns.
Now, obviously, the twins kind of went back on their word of not wanting to run from their military obligation. And this actually lasted for 2 years. And the pattern seemed to be that they would cause a lot of trouble, get caught by the police, and be returned to the army, where they would then escape again. And this would just repeat and repeat and repeat. And finally, after 2 years of dealing with the craze, the army just gave up and dishonorably discharged them, which the twins saw as a complete victory.
So what you're saying is, if you really want to get what you want, you've just got to be as much of an annoyance as humanly possible.
I think that's how I've gotten every relationship. I think. Not to me. Obviously, I'm a great guy to me. I'm fantastic. But, you know, I think to everybody else, I've been quite an annoyance, and they just kind of cave.
Yeah, I get that. I kind of relate to that on a similar level.
Now, the twins' discharge from the military was around 1953, which was around the same time that Ronnie Cray believes he began to lose his mind. And 3 years later, he would be found to be paranoid schizophrenic, which will come into play a lot later. He was very mentally sick, this man. So just know that this is kind of the starting moment where he starts to lose his mind.
But I think back then, though, they kind of diagnosed a lot of things with paranoid schizophrenia.
Like, they might have done, but I think he earned it. I think...
another one who earned his diagnosis. You might be right, but...
Now, at the age of 21 in 1954, the twins were finally free of the military and the police for the first time in 2 years. It was at this point that they started to dive into business ventures, which I think is pretty incredible for 21-year-olds. Now, they found out that there was a local billiards club that was being hassled by local thugs, and this made it difficult for the business to have regular customers. So the owner eventually got upset with the manager and fired him. So the Crays approached that owner and said they'll handle the problems in exchange for a lease of the business. The owner gave them a month to test, and the trouble stopped immediately because, as Ronnie explains in the book, if anyone would break anything in the club, they would simply break their bones in return. So the owner awarded the twins a 3-year lease. But after they won the lease, the twins were first introduced into the London protection racket. Now, a Maltese gang soon approached the twins in their billiards club, demanding protection money. Up to this point, they hadn't really had much experience in this protection racket business. Instead of giving them the money, the twins responded by pulling out knives and going for the gang, who quickly left and never returned. Because they thought, these guys are fucking insane.
Like, usually, like the films, they make it like, as soon as you like reject the protection racket, you're fucked. Your place is getting burnt down. Not that I was like, you owe us protection money. Shrink knife. Like, come here. I want your ears and your eyes.
You see these two twins with identical knives, identical clothes, and just running at you like, and one of them looking at you with this small gleam in his eye, looking like he really wants to make love to you as well.
He wants to fucking decapitate you and make love to your face.
And that's enough to scare any Maltese gang.
Yeah, but I've never really heard of a Maltese gang before.
I hadn't either before this story, actually, so I don't know. I'd never heard of that. Now, the protection racket, in a nutshell, was a form of illegal business where gangs would provide protection to local businesses from other gangs in exchange for a share of the business's profits. After being introduced to this form of business, the Crays saw its potential. Now, the timing of discovering this protection racket is very important. Again, no one trusted the police in the East End, but the people of the East End were then left with a mix of different gangs wanting their share of profits for protection. If they didn't have the police there to help, then they were kind of subject to these gangs. Sometimes a business would actually end up paying multiple gangs a week. And the Crays decided to swoop in and start policing the East End themselves. Since many businesses were already paying multiple gangs, they welcomed the idea of the Crays coming in and getting rid of the other gangs, meaning that they would now only have to pay one gang, the Crays. So even though they were getting, even though the businesses were still getting shaken down by the Crays, they were happy about it.
It's just one.
It's just one. And it's people that they know from the East End. They you know, this is Ronnie and Reggie Cray. You know, oh, they're from down the street. You know, Jimmy's grandson. You know, yeah. Like, they know, they know them. And they're like, yeah, we'll help. We'll pay you guys to protect us. So it's not a legitimate business. But I will say it's, like, more legitimate than these other gangs that were just coming in saying, we're going to kill you if you don't give us money.
Yeah.
Now, the twins were very successful with providing their protection. They had already built a name for themselves as fighters when they were younger. And the family name already had a history in the East End with Jimmy Cray, Jimmy Lee, and the Cray, Jimmy Cray, Charles Cray. All of them had kind of built up the name in the East End. So they were well known. This was bolstered by the fact that they took absolutely no shit when it came to this protection business. If someone was causing trouble for the twins, their businesses, or the businesses under their protection, the person would be beat within an inch of their life and sent to the hospital. And the Cray gang soon became known as The Firm, and they were feared.
See, that's, I'm not sure if that's where the football terminology comes from, because that's what they call, like, if there's, like, basically what a gang of football hooligans is, they're typically called a firm. That's like the outline for all of them. They're called a firm. They'll have their own names, but it's called a firm, I suppose, in the East End. I think the local football team there is Millwall, and their firm is known as being Mad Hard Bastards. So I'm not sure if that's where that name comes from, the firm.
Or if the gang name came from that. It could have came from either direction, maybe.
I suppose it could have. So
I'm not sure. That's interesting. I did not know that, though. That's interesting to know. Now, the news of their strict protection spread quickly around the East End, and soon businesses were actually approaching them for their protection, and they were offering them money for sometimes just a few minutes of their time. Some businesses would just ask Reggie and Ronnie to show up for a minute, have a drink in their bar, and that would be enough for them. After Ronnie and Reggie were seen in that establishment, it was their territory, and everyone knew not to cause any trouble.
Getting paid just to go and drink a few beers.
Are you fucking kidding me? No, they are absolutely... I mean, that's what years of fighting in alleys and beating everybody up gives you, I suppose.
I feel like when I enter a pub, everything should go off and I should be given free beer because of how tough and hard I am.
Yeah, nowadays you need to have a really good website.
Yeah.
Now, the Krays and their gang, The Firm, had certain rules that they seemed to live by pretty much throughout their entire lives, especially during their crimes. Firstly, you never grass on anyone for anything. Going to the police was seen as completely unforgivable, as we said earlier. Secondly, they never hurt those that couldn't defend themselves, so women, children, and the elderly were not to be harmed. And thirdly, apparently, they decided to never go on organized crimes, like organized robberies. I'll discuss that in just a moment. Now, ratting people out to the police is pretty self-explanatory. We've already gone into a lot of detail about that. But the issue with hurting kids is an interesting one because it very likely plays into the previously mentioned story about Reggie and his friend Alf killing the small child with the truck. Reggie says in his book that the sight of that child haunted him until his adulthood. So it always haunted him seeing that child.
Could that have been a link to his mental collapse?
No, no, sorry, this is Reggie. This is Reggie, not Ronnie.
Oh, yeah, okay, I got him wrong. I still get him confused in my head anyway.
I know. I'm not doing well at keeping him straight anyway, so the listeners are probably have no idea what's going on. So,
nope.
Are these guys Maltese or not? Now, we also mentioned that the twins would never go on organized robberies. The twins, rightfully so, were very concerned with the actual image of the firm. They felt that the firm needed to be seen as a proper organization and not one that dealt in petty crimes. They decided that they would never go on robberies because they considered this work the work of jailbirds, and in turn, it was beneath them in a way. However, it has been said that even though they didn't go on the robberies themselves, they would still demand their cut of the robbery if they knew a member of the team that did the robbery. If they did know somebody on the robbery team, they would go around asking for their share. And if the person didn't pay up, they were sent to the hospital. And now that information was from the documentary, not necessarily the Krays themselves. So take that with a grain of salt, please.
But they'd ask for the entire cut.
They would ask for their cut of their share. So if they knew the person that was on the team, they deserved a portion of that person's take from the robbery.
So they're essentially putting taxes on criminality, like they're taxing criminals.
I guess if you think about it, you can think about it as that robbery was a business operating in their territory. So if they're operating in their territory, they get profit from their businesses. So if you're robbing people, in their territory, or if you live in their territory and you're robbing people, you need to pay up because you're in their territory where they offer protection. So I suppose, you know, it's kind of just desserts, I guess. I don't know. Now, one of the biggest problems that the twins dealt with was the mental issues that Ronnie was developing. We mentioned earlier that Ronnie believed he was going mad after his enlistment from the military, or release from the military. Following a rough fight at a club in the West End, Ronnie was ratted out to the police by one of the rival gang members, and he was sent to the Wandsworth prison at the age of 23. However, he felt that he was in a great position in his life, even though he was in prison, and he was very proud of his accomplishments up to that point. And he even transferred this over to the prison, and he gained a large amount of clout within the prison, but once again, he still believed that he was going mad. For the last few months of his sentence, he was sent to Camp Hill, a much more relaxed type of prison, but Ronnie felt that it was much too far from his family and friends. He became depressed and withdrawn. Soon, the twins' Aunt Rose died of leukemia, and this only made Ronnie's mental state worse. He began to suspect that people in the prison were plotting against him, and anyone that he would see whispering to themselves, he would assume they were trying to kill him. He was declared insane and moved to Long Grove Mental Institution before his release from the prison. Here, he went into an even worse condition. He states himself that he thought the patient in the bed opposite him was a dog. And he couldn't recognize anybody that came to visit him. But then he was placed on strong medication and gradually began to feel normal again. However, he states that he was struggling inside the mental institution. So Ronnie and Reggie came up with a ridiculous plan. Now, Reggie decided to visit Ronnie with their brother Charlie. Their visit was actually quite pleasant, and Reggie and Charlie left. Once they were in the car, it was revealed that Reggie hadn't actually left. The twins had switched clothes, and Ronnie had left with Charlie. And soon after, Reggie approached the guard and showed him his ID and said he was going home. And since he wasn't a patient there, they had to let him leave.
But did he walk? Did he walk over in like his pants? Like, surely wouldn't they? Did they not have like special clothes for people in mental institutions to?
Yeah, they switched clothes. But the thing is that Reggie kept his ID, so he showed them the ID and said, "and said I'm Reggie Cray. I'm not Ronnie Cray. So you can't keep me here." So they just released him. They couldn't legally keep him there. Now the plan was that if Ronnie could do well outside the mental institution, then the government would need to review his admission and release him if he could survive well enough on the outside. Oddly enough, it actually worked. He voluntarily returned to the hospital after a few months of being on the outside, and then he was released a few months later. But his mental health was still as severe as ever. And I actually want to read a quick point on his mental health that I thought was very, very funny from the book. I'm going to read this verbatim from the book Our Story, and it's Reggie describing Ronnie when he goes into a mental fit, kind of, and it shows his mental instability, really. One of the stage acts we used was called Tex the Dwarf. He was a midget who wore an enormous Texan hat. He would climb on the back of a donkey and strum away on a guitar and sing cowboy songs. At the end of the act, Ron would walk to the stage and lead the donkey over to the bar by its reins. One night, Ron had just led the donkey over to the corner of the bar, and he'd got the donkey's reins in his left hand and a glass of gin and tonic in his right. At that moment, in walked a bookmaker who owed Ron a large amount of money. When Ron spotted the bookmaker, he went bloody berserk and started telling the bookie he better pay up or else. I just stood watching. It was bloody hilarious. There was Ron gesticulating and laying down the law in general with a donkey in one hand and a gin and tonic in the other. The bookie didn't seem to see the funny side of it, though, and sped out of the club fairly promptly.
It's just about like I can picture it, just like, again, like you walk in and if so, like, this again, these borderline psychopath just shouting with a donkey and a gin, even the gin and tonic, this questions asked there, and they're like, what the fuck is going on here?
Just sitting there screaming, I'm giving my fucking money, what the fuck are you doing? He's like, there's just a donkey there. Now this next part of the story, we'll need to yada yada over a little bit of it for this episode. We might revisit some of the more previous parts of Ronnie's life, but we're going to get into a little bit of Ronnie's sexuality. Unbeknownst to quite a few people, mainly everyone, Ronnie was actually homosexual. It has been claimed that he was also a pedophile, but we cannot substantiate those claims. We do know that he was at least homosexual. This news came out due to a story in the Daily Mirror that stated that Ronnie was in a homosexual relationship with a member of the House of Lords. Ronnie denied this relationship had occurred, but he never denied that he was homosexual. Ronnie was actually quite pleased that this news had been broken. He was happy that he could actually be himself, and he writes that in his book. But some people didn't quite like it, and they made it known, which was not a smart thing to do, especially to Ronnie, and especially because he's so fucking nuts.
Again, he's not someone you really want to be going around throwing gay slurs at, is it, really?
He is not. Because he will
fucking go mental. But it was a sign of the times, though, as well, where, like, it's not like how it is today, where it's only slightly more accepted. I don't think it's as it should be, really. But back then, it was definitely frowned upon.
Yeah,
it wouldn't have been understood.
I suppose so. Which is weird because in Greek times they just had sex with everything. So you know,
yeah, that was the Greeks' way of looking at things, I guess. But
yeah, when in Rome, you know what I mean.
When in Rome, oh, cock here, cock there, vagina there. It's all totally fine. In England, I think England's always had kind of a hard time grasping homosexuality.
I think that came from the wave of Christianity that flooded the country.
That makes a lot of sense, you know.
Yeah, I think that's where, because obviously it wasn't, I don't think around the barbarian times that they really gave a shit. I truly don't. I don't think they did. And then, I mean, obviously it was a huge thing in archaic times. They talk about men having sex with men all the time, but I don't see it as being a punishable offense until the church gets involved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Cray twins and the firm had one particular rival gang that was known as the Richardson Gang. And the Richardsons were actually very sadistic. The Crays dealt relatively tamely with people unless it was otherwise necessary. They would beat the crap out of people if they needed to, but they were mostly tame in general. The Richardsons, however, were known to use torture and sadism to control their territory. The gangs obviously didn't get along, and they had a long-running feud. Even so, the Crays tried their best to live in somewhat harmony. They felt that uncontrollable gang warfare would not only be a waste of time, but it would damage their public image, because that was very important to them. Well, the Crays had decided that they were going to expand to working with the American Mafia in hopes that they would sponsor casinos in London, making the gang an enormous profit. The Crays even decided to let the Richardsons in on the deal, which is insane. That is a huge olive branch.
Yeah, big call.
To take these millions of pounds and, you know, you will share in this with us. So a meeting was set up with all of the parties present to discuss the deal. One member of the Richardson's gang caused a bit of a scene at the meeting, George Cornell. This meeting took place soon after the news of Ronnie's homosexuality had come out. Cornell decided to speak up during the meeting and ended up calling Ronnie a big fat poof. But I think it's pronounced poof.
It's puff.
Puff, yeah. Now, Ronnie describes that moment as the moment he decided that Cornell would die. Now, soon after the meeting, the Richardsons launched an attack on the Crays at a local pub, thinking that the Crays would be inside themselves. Unluckily for the Richardsons, there was only one member of the firm in the pub, and the rest were all hardened gangsters ready for a fight. And a huge fight broke out, and all the Richardsons' gang were either arrested or killed, except for that son of a bitch, George Cornell.
That little bastard!
That little bastard. Now, unfortunately for Cornell, they had actually killed the one member of the firm in the pub that night. So Ronnie decided that they needed revenge, and Cornell might as well be the target.
Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense. He did call him a fat poof.
Exactly. The night following the attack, Ronnie found out that Cornell was drinking at the Blind Beggar. And this was a brazen move on Cornell's part, because this pub was on Cray territory. So Ronnie headed over with his 9mm pistol. Now, there are a lot of conflicting accounts on what occurred in the Blind Beggar on March 9th, 1966. Some say the pub was packed with 33 people, including one barmaid and Cornell. However, Ronnie's account is a bit different. He stated that there were only a handful of people. Now, the first account also states that George Cornell was sitting in the corner facing the door, and Ronnie's account has him with his back to him. Either way, when Ronnie strolled into the bar, he walked straight towards Cornell. Cornell noticed Ronnie, smirked, and sneered at him, and said, "Well, look who's here." And without a word, Ronnie brought out his pistol and fired a single shot straight between Cornell's eyes. And Cornell fell to the bar, and everybody dispersed from the bar.
Fucking hell.
Now, Ronnie was taken into custody shortly after this, but not one of the 33 or handful of people, whichever one you want to go with, none of them talked, and they were forced to release Ronnie on lack of evidence. This was the first time a Cray twin had killed a man, but it would not be the last murder the Crays would commit. And that's where we'll pick up on next week's episode, the conclusion of our series on the Cray twins.
Oh, it's going to be a good one. Those slags, those fucking slags, yeah. Fucking hell, London. Yeah, wee.
Next episode has a couple of murders in it, actually. And we're going to discuss a bit more of the love interests of both Ronnie and Reggie, but it's more based on the murders they caused and that sort of thing. So it is going to be a bit gruesome. And then we're going to obviously talk about everything up into their death. So definitely tune in next week. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed part one. Whatever device you're listening on, if you're not subscribed, if you could subscribe, that would really help us out. So please do that. If you want to follow the show and look into more in-depth information about the show, you can go to unfortunatehistory.com. That has all of the show notes and my scripts and that sort of thing for each episode. You can also listen to all of the episodes directly on our website. I've tried it out. If you press play on our website and you close the screen, if you turn off your screen, my phone, it keeps playing. So it might still keep playing on yours. So if you don't want to listen to us through any of the apps, feel free to go to our website. Either way, it helps us out. Also, don't forget we have our new merch store, shop.unfortunatehistory.com. Feel free to check that out. We've already had some orders on that. Thank you so much, everybody, for ordering. And be warned that shipping times may take a while because of COVID. Sorry, I know it's a bummer. If you want to follow me, just Google Cody Pennington and you'll find me anywhere online. Greg?
Yep, with me. So same as always, just Facebook, find me at Greg's, just search Greg Skinner. And on Instagram, I am still Flight of the Emu.
Woo!
As reference to our last episode. All right! Yeah, I've enjoyed this episode so far, and I'm very excited for the next one.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Yeah,
leave us a review if you feel like we're doing well, or let us know if we're doing shit. We'll take anything on board, but just know I'll be so upset if you don't like it.
Yeah, and we'll find you. We'll send our protection racket to find you and take care of you.
If you don't like it, you slags, we'll come there for a shootout.
Yeah, fuck you, like Western. Like a Western. All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. But unfortunately, we got to go. So stay unfortunate.
Stay unfortunate, guys. Ta-ra.
Bye.